And it's a good Wednesday. Welcome into the Brad Sesmatch Show. My name is Jared Cohen. That's Paula Bovin of AZ Central Sports filling in for Brad today. He might check in with us, though, at some point during the show as Grand Canyon University has announced their new athletic director. We'll keep you posted on that, but we have a great show ahead talking to Michael Fabiano, our weekly segment with him we do each and every week to talk fantasy football. It's always one of my favorite segments. And also Lincoln Kennedy, former NFL star offensive tackle for the Oakland Raiders for a long time. He is now the sideline analyst for the Oakland Raiders as the Cardinals will be traveling to Oakland, so we'll get the Raiders' perspective of things. But again, as mentioned, Paula, it's great to have you. I would like doing this show with you. It's coming more frequent now, which I like, and it's great to have you.
Good to be here, and always good to come off a exciting baseball game, or we've got some huge football games coming up, so I'm dying to talk to someone about it.
Okay,
so this is good.
I will be that person for you. No need to worry. Let's get into some of those things. It's the top stories in the first hour, brought to you by the Honda Resort and Casino, which is located in the beautiful White Mountains just outside of Pine Top in eastern Arizona. Head up there now and enjoy their fall weather. Yep, it's getting cooler outside. That's the Honda Resort and Casino. And let's talk baseball right off the top as you're dying to talk to someone about it. And let's start with the night game first. The Royals with a 2-0 lead over the Baltimore Orioles, and they have a chance to win down the stretch. This is how it all shaped up.
Lined up the middle, Infante behind second has got it. Throw in time. The Royals win it by the score of 2-1, and they are one win away from the World Series.
The Royals are one win away from the World Series. Now, in my lifetime, that is something I've never heard, for the most part.
I have to be honest, when they got into the postseason, I thought they were going to be out quickly. I did not think they were going to win every single game in this postseason. And they're the team, they're the darlings. I mean, everybody was just excited they got in the postseason. And the way they've been winning it, you know, defense helped them out again. They've had all these weird quirks to their season. But I've been really, really impressed.
Now, you mentioned defense and also pitching. That seems to be the thing that separates teams this time of year in the playoffs, and Ned Yost talks about how once again his bullpen was lights out down the stretch.
When we had first and third and Billy was up, you know, my whole mindset was, Billy, find a way to get the ball in the air, score this run, and we're going to turn it over to Kelvin, Wade, and Holly. Odds of us winning this game are going to be great.
And from the Orioles side of things, Steve Pierce, their first baseman, who had a monster season, especially in the second half, he has struggled in the playoffs, and he had one of my favorite quotes that I saw come down after that game, saying it's hard to take advantage of mistakes when they're not making any. They have been that good through the wild card game, the wild card series, and now the ALCS. They're not making any mistakes, and they're taking advantage of every opportunity that they have. It's amazing.
It is amazing. And when you think of where this team was during the season and some of the crap that, like, Ned Yost was taking about how he was using his pitchers, and I thought last night, I think it was Jeremy Guthrie, right? He didn't stretch him past five innings. It was just good decision-making.
Yeah, they went to the bullpen in the sixth.
And that bullpen delivered. And so the decision-making has been great, which is one of the things they've been catching grief about. It feels, I know this sounds so hokey, but it feels kind of magical. They're just making the right decisions. You know, people are stepping up with these amazing hits, amazing defensive plays like last night.
Mike Moustakas, that play, diving over into the fans, and the fans catch him like he was crowd surfing.
And put him back up. It was
and then
great.
Bring him back up. And great. Oh, it was great. There was also another point in that game, and I don't know if you caught this part or not, something really little and minuscule in the grand scheme of things. I'm blanking on the Royals' first base coach's name at the moment, but there was a foul ball that almost, it didn't almost hit him, but it was hit in his direction, and he kind of dodged out of the way and kind of, you know, ran towards the side, and on the opposite side of that kind of square next to the dugout where the fans were that caught Moustakas when he went over, he ran on the first base side to that group of fans that was in that same box, and he gave a bunch of them high fives as he was ran away from the ball, as if to say, way to get out of the way of that one. Like, the fans fired up for something as small as that. As you said, there's magic and it sounds hokey, but I think there is really something to that, and they're riding this momentum that just can't be explained other than what they're putting out on the field and the reflection of where the series is at this point.
You know, a lot of times that magic is sort of born from just teams playing well, and maybe you interpret it as magic. But when we've both have covered so many sports, and we hear that expression all the time, you know, the ball's bouncing in their favor. But you kind of see it happen with good teams when they're playing well, when everything is firing all cylinders. It also feels like they catch the breaks, too, and that sure seems what's happening with the Royals.
That's Paula Bovin of AZ Central Sports. I'm Jared Cohen. We're filling in for Brad today. The other game
there
was another game earlier in the day is in the National League, the Giants and the Cardinals, two teams unlike the Orioles and the Royals were a little bit more accustomed to talking about in October. Another exciting finish in this one. As we talk about the Royals not making any mistakes, this actually ended on a mistake made by the Cardinals.
And the pitch, and Blanco bunts it, and it's a good bunt. Schoen has it. He will wing it down the right field line. Here comes Crawford, and this game is over. And the Giants once again win a game in a very unusual way as this crowd goes crazy.
They showed a stat during the game and in the middle of it where the Cardinals have only at that point, and I don't know if it changed over the course of the game. I don't have the top of my head, but when it was 4-0 at one point in the Cardinals-Giants game, they showed a statistic where the Cardinals have only scored runs on home runs or hits. They hadn't scored on anything else. Meanwhile, the Giants had scored on home runs, errors, sacrifices, you name it, just about everything. And it ended up being the case where they win on a run like that. A team a lot like the Royals, where they take advantage of teams making mistakes and kind of play small ball, don't do anything flashy or don't do anything over the top. They just take advantage of what you give them and they make you pay.
It has been, and that's a great comparison. I mean, even last night's game, there was a lot of wind. The wind was swirling. Weird things were happening. You talk about the bunt and the wild pitch, and it seems like that's defined the Giants, and it makes it almost feel like that's one of the reasons this team is going to be the one advancing the World Series. They kind of dig in and find ways to get it done, even if it's not in a traditional sense.
Yeah, as much as I don't want to see the Giants in the World Series, the Giants against the Royals would just be, it would be incredible. It would be incredible. Here's Randy Choate, the player that had the error in the former Diamondback, after the game, talking about that last play.
1-1 fastball right down the middle. He did exactly what I wanted him to do. He's been doing PFPs since I was a kid. Been doing my every spring training all the time, and I mean, it was easy. It was right there, and I blew at the ball. Just sailed on me.
Randy Choate, I saw this tweet come down after the game. Can't remember who, so I apologize for not giving that person a shout out because it was a great stat. Randy Choate has now pitched in 4 postseason games, all of which obviously since he left the Diamondbacks, because I don't think he pitched for the Diamondbacks while they were in the playoffs. 3 of those games, he's committed an error at the pitcher position.
How do you sort of move on from that? The guy's going to need therapy after this season.
Seriously, absolutely is. And so let's kind of go a little bit broader before we change topics here, just to close on this note of baseball. This is now the 13th game of this postseason, which has been decided by one run, if you include the Giants and the Royals from yesterday. The 12th and 13th game, which matches a record which was set in 2011 and also tied again last year. Now, everyone talks about, oh, I only care about football this time of year. I'm not watching. Baseball, though, is relevant, and it's making headlines and a reason why we're talking about it at the top of the show because of how incredible the postseason has been this year and the great storylines attached to it.
And, Jared, I think Major League Baseball needed this.
Sure.
You know, they needed these one-run games. They needed the – I mean, you know, you're writing a script of how you want the postseason. This is it. A team that hasn't been in the postseason in decades. Okay, now you've got that. Games that are determined by one run, now you have that. It's like somebody wrote a script for this postseason. It's exactly what baseball needed. You know, you're right. I mean, football is king. The NFL is king. The NBA is about to start. Those who aren't hardcore fans lose interest in baseball at this time of the season very quickly. This is the boost they needed. Is it going to make them, you know, America's favorite sport? It's not going to happen. But at least I think Major League Baseball can feel good about itself.
They're doing the best they can. They're making it interesting, that's for sure. That's Paula Bovin of AZ Central Sports. I'm Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad on the Brad Sesmat Show. Switching gears to more a little bit of a local angle, Stanford back into town, the team that has just absolutely owned Arizona State since Todd Graham took over as head coach. I guess it's only one season of a display because they did not face Stanford the first season that Graham was head coach. I made a note of this in an article I wrote yesterday. Stanford outscored ASU 80-49 in the two games combined. And that almost is almost too many points and almost too close to describe what the last two games have been like. But quarterback is always the item of conversation at just about any level of football, really. I mean, even when we talk high school, you talk quarterbacks and how it affects teams. But you were out at ASU's practice yesterday, and Todd Graham talked about how Bercovici, he's still holding on to the fact that he thinks Kelly can play, but threw in there that both of them might get reps. You've been enough to enough coach speak, press conference interviews.
Yes, I have.
To understand when gamesmanship is involved or when there might actually be some factors involved, where do you rank this?
I would say a greater percentage is gamesmanship. You know, it was funny because I was at practice yesterday and I'm kind of half listening to Graham and I was tweeting something else, as we all are multitasking these days. And he said that about the quarterbacks and I kind of turned my head. I'm like, what's going on here? I think a lot of it's gamesmanship. Anytime you can try to force the opposition to have to prepare for both quarterbacks, it's taking attention away from one quarterback, which they want. So I think there's a lot of that. You know, I watched Kelly. He walked off the field. He looked like he was fine. But there's just kind of a vibe with him right now. I'm sure he's so frustrated and disappointed he's not playing. I don't think we're going to see him a lot. I don't know if this is going to be kind of a Michael Eubank thing.
For ASU's fake and ASU's fans' sake, I hope not.
Right.
Because
yeah, it wasn't good. And I don't know if there's goal line situations where you'd use Taylor Kelly. But I think against Stanford, you want your quarterback to have some rhythm. Put Kelly in a little bit, maybe that's fine. But I think if Bercovici is your guy, you have to stick with him. You need rhythm in that offense against Stanford.
I just don't think it's worth it. You know, right. I think you maybe look at Kelly if ASU goes down big early, and you're just trying to find some sort of spark or trying to find something that's a different look and get something going, because they've fallen down early both times they faced them last year, where they all of a sudden look up and they're down three scores.
Right.
That's been the problem the last two times they faced Stanford. And if that happens again with Bercovici at quarterback, I think maybe that's when you look to Kelly. But either way, it's not worth it to play Kelly if you think Bercovici can compete with these guys, because why risk further injury or why risk playing a player that's not ready when you still have the meat of your schedule ahead of you with at Washington?
Absolutely.
Home against Utah is no pushover anymore. Home against Notre Dame, you're going into a game which is almost the swing game, which can create a lot of momentum for the rest of the season. So why risk it? That's where I'm at, though.
Yeah, you down that stretch, you want your best quarterback available. And right now, I know people are arguing it a little bit. It is Taylor Kelly.
For sure.
And it's a big game. Stanford allowing just 10 points per game, that defense. Number one in the country.
That's Paula Bovin of AZ Central Sports. I'm Jared Cohen. We're filling in for Brad today. Coming up next, Aaron Rodgers has seen enough and thinks you have as well. We'll explain that next on Sports360AZ.com and AZ Central Sports.
Like our Facebook fan page for unique Arizona sports content from the high schools to the pros. Facebook.com/Sports360AZ.
AZ Central Sports and Sports 360 AZ, Jared Cohen and Paula Bovin filling in for Brad Sesmat today. And to pay off the masterful Eric Sorensen tease from last segment on Aaron Rodgers has seen enough and thinks you have too, it's a very interesting topic and a topic very prevalent for us and what you do on a day-to-day basis and what I try to act like I do on a day-to-day basis is he was on the Dan Patrick Show and he had very interesting comments about how the media is given too much access into the NFL, whether it's in the locker rooms and games or whatever it is. And I'll let him do the talking. This is what he had to say on the DP show about the access that is given to people outside of the game.
I hate it. Yeah, I hate that. I don't like it at all. Well, it's too much access. I mean, a couple games ago, I got bumped in the back of the head by a camera guy who was trying to get into a a pregame huddle. I'm just like, what? What are you doing?
And then he goes on to say that the coverage is over the top with all of this different stuff.
Yeah, like nothing you're filming here is going to be used for consumption on TV, because you have to bleep out every single word. You know, it's like after a game, they rush you, and I'm just trying to go see somebody I might know on the other team. I just think, you know, the access is over the top. I mean, I think you can use a camera with the $50,000 cameras they got and zoom in to get some of the same shots you're getting.
And I couldn't agree more. You know, as much as I like to take in the NFL as a fan, I agree with him. It is a little bit out of control. And I think that there are times where they do kind of overstep some boundaries. It is a product of the time that we live in now, and that's things that the players are going to have to embrace.
Sure.
But at the same time, it is. I mean, the fact that he's getting hit over the head with the camera. I've been that guy holding a camera amongst scrums, and it sucks.
Right.
Okay. It drives me nuts, and it's not fun. None of the guys like doing it, but if they don't get the shot, they're reamed out.
Well, and
you know?
That's what I was going to say.
And that's part of it.
Explain to our listeners, because I don't know if they understand, why is it so competitive sometimes in those situations? Because there's probably only certain spaces where you can get in and get the decent shot, right? And then you'll catch crap if you don't.
I have not been in anything like that on a post, like after the game, where I right. run out and I try to get a specific shot. But I have been involved in scrums, media scrums, camera scrums, where it's basically, use Todd Graham as an example. Todd Graham comes off the field for his post-practice interview, and if I'm standing and I slack off and I don't kind of box myself into a certain position, I'm going to get either the back of his head or the side of his face.
Sure.
And when you have a talking head, which is in the business what it's called, but when you have Graham talking, you don't want to look at him from the side of his face, because all you can hear is the sound and you're looking at his ear or the back of his head. And from a visual standpoint, that doesn't look good.
Right.
So you need to be able to work your way in and move for that shot. And if you don't get it, there's people that will be in your ear about
right,
it.
Right.
So that's something that you have to think about. You have to work towards. There have been times where they'll set up a spot for you to talk to Graham, for example, but all the cameras will kind of push forward to make sure they have a better angle or better leverage or a better shot. And it sucks when you're doing the interviews and you have to hold the camera above your head. All of a sudden your lats and your shoulders just start to die. And maybe you have to bring your arm down for a rest. And you don't get the shot. As a part of this whole rant, there is a job to do, and right. there is things that need to be done. However, the access that the NFL allows these people to be able to have, and the microphones that attach to it as well, is prevalent, because nothing is off. Like nothing is, everything is documented.
No, it is. And two things in reaction to what you're saying. One, part of the challenge in what you were just talking about is there is now a new layer of media. It used to be print media, and it used to be television media. Now there is a social media, and there's great media that you'll find obviously on your internet and things like that. So there's a challenge because the numbers have increased. The other problem, and I'm really sort of torn on this situation, because I think the greater access we have now in the NFL has made players more human to a lot of people. So you sort of see them preparing, and you see what they're going through and what they're talking about in a huddle. And I think there's been great value in the relationship between fan and player because of it. But I do think there has to be some sacred areas, and you were addressing this, Jared. I don't think we have to have a microphone in the pregame huddle, because I think there is, you know, whether it's strategy, whether it's foul language, there has to be a place on the field, at least for a while, where players can feel like they can be themselves. Because if they're standing there and they're worried about something that's going to come across on the microphone or something like that, that's a concern. I think there's a fine line that the NFL has to sort of walk with this. I agree with you. There's some areas, maybe too much access, but I'd hate to see a lot of it go away.
And there's also been, that you mentioned, there's times where you're in the locker room, mm-hmm. and it's kind of awkward,
yeah.
because you're just kind of hanging in there, you're waiting, you're doing your thing, and that's almost an access thing, too, that's a little bit bizarre, because, I mean, you bring up the point in particular of that's done in Major League Baseball with the Diamondbacks, and there's like a 2-3 hour window where it's just open until
right.
they basically go out for batting practice, and then that's when it's done, and it's just it's kind of a weird, almost too much type of situation, even though it's important for people like you and I to do our jobs.
Yeah, the pregame access is very valuable, because you can get information about things for the game coming up that will help you write your story and interviews and everything. And as a female sports writer, that's been my least favorite part of the whole baseball access before the game thing, because you stand around, and you can tell, for the most part, baseball players don't want you in their sacred space. I mean, the Diamondback players are very accommodating and everything else, but you can tell it's uncomfortable. I wouldn't be surprised to see that window close a little bit down the road. afterward is another challenge because we're facing deadlines. People are like, why do you have to go into the locker room or clubhouse after a game? We have to get in there so we can provide, whether it's sound bites or quotes and stories.
Reactions.
And that they're fresh and not contrived after, if they get to sit around and wait half an hour, it's not going to be the same quotes. So.
And both are equally as important because when you go, you're someone that likes to do more feature-driven things, mm-hmm. kind of like with what we do with Sports 360. You kind of want to get the backstory. You're trying to tell a story to get more background. You can't really do that in a post-game setting.
No.
Because the game just ended, the mindset is different, the time is shortened. So the pregame aspect is important because that's where you get a lot of the stuff that you need, and it's the only time to really be able to do so. But at the same time, it's a lot of time you're given.
It is a lot of time.
And it's a big window. So.
But I do, you know, going back to the Rodgers thing, I do see where he's coming from. If you go onto the NFL Network, there are some unbelievable shows with access, you know, following their whole day, their practice, the sound bites. And there's, I think if they approach it in sort of a sensitive manner of how much they cover and not cover, I think it still works, and I think it's important for the health of the NFL and the relationship with fans. But it, like I said, there has to be some sacred areas.
And honestly, guys, it all goes back to Hard Knocks. I mean,
right.
The people love access. They love to get behind the scenes, the common fan. And the NFL is all about, we want as much exposure as possible. I don't know how many cameras the networks have at every NFL game, but I'm guessing it's got to be, 15, 20 cameras?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And they're sprinkled all around the stadium. So when a guy goes back to the locker room, even if the team's trying to be discreet about an injury, there's usually like a Fox or CBS camera, you know, showing him walking down the tunnel,
right.
Holding his arm. Nothing is sacred, and I understand the NFL wants to make the experience as best they possibly can to the viewers and to the listeners. But you can see Aaron Rodgers' point. I mean, the field is kind of their sanctuary. It's
right.
kind of their air. That's their. It's kind of like two dogs. That's their space. Each has their own space. The players are on the field. The media shouldn't be allowed on the field as much as they are.
As a football consumer at the level that you are at both levels, is it something that you enjoy, or is it something that you kind of think to yourself, you know, this might be a little bit too much?
I enjoy it, but now that Aaron Rodgers, what he said on Dan Patrick about just this, it's getting ridiculous, and it's also kind of a bit of a safety concern. I mean, you've got players that are trying to greet each other, and the people that are running on the field with their cameras. I mean, some players are not wearing helmets,
yeah,
and it could get a little bit dicey. I mean, you see instances where players are getting hurt and things like that, and I don't know, like, tensions are pretty high after games. Who knows? You wouldn't want to see a media member get caught in a situation where he or she is in between something that they shouldn't be.
You know, let me tell you the other side of that. I was on the sidelines for the SC-ASU game, and I'm usually in the press box because those games start so late, but I had the opportunity because it was earlier for the final 3 minutes. I went on the field immediately and probably got some of the best stuff I've ever gotten because you're seeing Mike Bercovici laying there on the ground, people piling onto him, and you're hearing his very first words to the network, interviewers. So there's such great material. You have to strike the right balance.
Yeah, it's a catch-22.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to strike the right balance, and there has to be better guidelines because it can get dangerous, and mm-hmm. I can see why teams don't want the media down there on the field as much as they are.
And it's your job to tell that story,
right.
to be there and to do it right and
right.
not take the words from the players themselves and the coaches themselves in the moment because
right.
that might be over-fabricated or not said well enough, and
sure.
it's your job to tell that story. So it's a really tough debate to have being in the industry. But I listen to Aaron Rodgers' comments, and I can't help but now feel a little bit more conscious of it,
yeah.
and to try to not be that guy that accidentally bumps him in the head with the camera or do something where it's just like, dude, get away from me.
And right. you know, Jared, there's a way that the networks can capture this on-the-field experience and not get in the way. Sky cams. Those things that are set up during the games
they
that go from sideline
well
to sideline.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to get a great visual shot looking down on the players. You could do that. And that no one's getting in anyone's way. But again, Rodgers said it, a lot of things that happen during the game are what concern him. Just the pregame huddle and them getting all fired up and the profanity. I mean, like you said, the networks can't use that stuff anyway. It's so true. Why do they want to be in there in the first place?
I wouldn't be surprised if we see the next collective bargaining agreement with the Players Association will bring some of these concerns. And I'm not sure how it works with the television networks, but maybe that's where they try to draw the line a little bit and keep people from coming.
That's Paula Bovin. That's also Eric Sorensen. I'm Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad today. It brings up I had a unique experience. Mm-hmm. When I was with Fox Sports Arizona, when they did remember they would do their catcher day with Joe Garagiola,
yeah, sure,
and they
sure.
would mic up, you know, Chris Snyder.
Right.
I was the guy that listened to Chris Snyder all game.
Oh, no. Okay.
Okay. And if you dealt with Chris Snyder, you know Chris Snyder. He's a good guy,
yep.
But very vulgar.
Yes.
And not afraid to speak his mind about things. And my favorite story from working that game was, because I was listening to him literally the entire game and I had to make notes of things that are usable. There were not very many things that were actually usable from that game. And it makes you wonder when I was that guy once that listens to these mics. There are people out there that do this for the NFL, and everything is recorded, and everything wow. is, and you almost look at the situation with like Donald Sterling, where
sure.
things were recorded, and you never know when things are said, and you know
was it a lot of profanity or
there
what
was some profanity, right. and there was some other you know things that were said that probably wouldn't have wanted to been repeated.
Gotcha.
It was around the time Dan Heron was on the trading block, you know,
okay.
and just, you know, it's almost the type of thing where it's not fair that someone is actually listening.
Right.
Especially the way things can get out. You know, they trust me. They had me sign things, a thing that you have to make sure you don't air this, and this, and you don't repeat it.
Sure.
But you can't really trust a person with that. If you find out something juicy and someone wants to have something go viral,
right.
how do you expect that to be kept under wraps if it's being recorded and someone's listening? It's kind of frightening.
Yeah.
So anyways, that's AZ Central Sports. It's Paula Bovin. I'm Jared Cohen of Sports 360 AZ, filling in for Brad Sestamat today. Coming up next, a guy I have a lot of respect for and have enjoyed working with in the past, Lincoln Kennedy, former NFL Oakland Raider lineman, now Oakland Raider radio broadcast analyst. He's going to join us next as we're getting close to Cardinals and Raiders coming up on Sunday. So don't go anywhere. Lincoln Kennedy joins us next.
For in-depth, unique coverage from the high schools to the pros, follow us on Twitter at Sports360AZ.
Jared Cohen and Paula Bovin filling in for Brad Sestamat today on Sports360AZ.com and AZ Central Sports. And we've got the Arizona Cardinals coming up this Sunday, taking on the Oakland Raiders in Oakland. In this segment, we're going to be joined by a man that knows the Raiders extremely well, spent a lot of time playing with them, and is also now their radio analyst on the sidelines for their radio broadcast. Lincoln Kennedy joins us here on the Brad Sestamat Show. Link, how are things, my man?
Wonderful, man. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Doing great, doing great. You could also, Lincoln was also the Arizona Rattlers color commentator for their third straight championship run. Got to know him very well doing that. But Lincoln, we're talking NFL this segment, and right off the bat, you know, I want to tell the story so everyone can hear it. Lincoln, before the draft, says to me, mark my word, the Raiders are going to draft Derek Carr in the second round. And that was at a time where people thought Derek Carr might go in the first round, maybe even to the Cardinals.
Right.
Sure enough,
right.
draft happens, and there's Derek Carr in the second round of the Raiders. And now, fast forward to today, he's starting. So how's he looking for you?
So far, so good. I mean, I think it's been a long time since the Raiders could say they had a franchise quarterback. As a matter of fact, I probably have to go back to the days I was playing in the early 2000s with Rich Gannon. But I think they definitely have their quarterback for the future, and I know they're pleased that they got great value at him, and he's also played so well to date.
Is that why this offense is looking a lot sharper than it has? Is he been the biggest difference maker, or are there other things kind of coming into place for you guys, for the Raiders?
Well, there's no doubt he's been the biggest difference maker. I think, you know, it was certainly shown during the preseason, as much as you can take out of preseason. The Raiders had their third preseason game where against the defending world champion Seattle Seahawks in Oakland. And the coaching staff and even people like me from the sidelines noticed there was an energy that was present on the offense when Derek Carr was at the helm that wasn't present with Matt Schaub or anybody else for that matter since the Raiders in the last couple of years. So it was something that they could definitely build off of. Now, given that in, you know, taking that in consideration, you got to remember he's still a rookie, so there's going to be a learning curve. And I think that learning curve was proved the first week against the Jets. Even though the Jets were a little depleted on defense, they actually statistically looked like they better than they really were. But since then, he's grown. He's progressed every week. Now, he learned lessons. He's going to learn lessons every week like every other player, especially playing in this league. But, you know, the thing is that he's shown that he's not afraid to look down the field. He's got a good arm. He's pretty consistent with his decisions and hasn't made a lot of mistakes. He hasn't cost the Raiders a lot of games.
Lincoln Kennedy, this is the Oakland Raider radio sideline reporter for the Arizona, excuse me, the Oakland Raiders broadcast network. I almost said Arizona Rattlers just there. I swear.
I know. I really
it almost rolls off the tongue. Let's talk, Link. You know, Andre Holmes is one of the new guys that we got to meet last week. He has 20 targets in the last 2 weeks from Derek Carr. You know, there's receivers that are on paper supposed to be the number one guys, but this seems to be the number one guy from what we've seen on the field the last couple weeks.
What I've noticed over the last couple of years, the trend is quarterbacks are going with taller receivers. They like the ability to, if you will, to throw that back shoulder fade, which is incredibly hard to defend. But if you have a taller receiver, especially that has a height advantage over a defender, then you're finding you have more of an advantage for the play to be successful. And Andre Holmes has got that great blend of size as well as speed. We saw it on that 70-yard drop they had last week against the Chargers to open up the game. It's one of those things that Derek has definitely taken consideration, but you also look at James Jones, and he spread the ball around. The Raiders don't have the luxury of having a lot of weapons at receiver, and their offense has sort of been stagnant, coming into its own, if you will. It showed more improvement this past week against the Chargers, but they don't really have a lot of, you know, big-name receivers like, conversely, or the Arizona Cardinals. They don't have Floyd or Fitzgerald on the other side.
You know, Lincoln, it's been interesting watching the Cardinals and how they've talked to Jonathan Cooper and talked about him. I think there's definitely been some frustration. I think there was a feeling that he was going to make that transition a little bit quicker. What for you has been, and obviously this was a guy who also dealt with an injury, but what have you found has been the toughest adjustment, guys that are standouts in college on the offensive line, then go to the pros?
The speed. And I think you'll hear that unanimously from every professional you talk to. What's the biggest difference from college to the pro? The speed of the game. I'll never forget my first year. I was originally drafted by Atlanta, and I was playing. We were playing the Rams in an opening season game, and Sean Gilbert was across from me. And I was playing. I started at guard, same position that Cooper is right now. I started at guard when I first came into the league, and I looked at Sean Gilbert, and here was a guy who was, you know, kind of stocky, you know, big build. Didn't look like he was going to try to run around me. I assumed he was going to try to run through me. I prepared to take on the full force of his blow, and he went around me in the blink of an eye. I mean, it looked like I was standing still, and it stunned me because it's like, oh my gosh, he's extremely quick. That's what you have to get used to. Those are the things that game speed, when a guy can go around you that fast and you're just left in your dust, that's what stands out. And sometimes that's the hardest transition because, look, you talk about some of these premier players that come out of college, they're not met with a lot of adversity. Mm-hmm. You might see a first round or a future draft choice maybe once, you know, every 3-4 weeks, whatever. You're seeing top-notch talent every single week. Game speed. It's much faster than you've ever been used to, and no matter how you do it in practice, it would be secondary to what you see at game speed.
You got to see Lincoln Carson Palmer for a few years while he was with the Raiders. What have you seen? And first of all, one thing that I think a lot of people out here didn't know about Carson was that he's really a warrior, especially from what we saw last week with him coming back from the shoulder injury and helping lead them to victory over the Redskins. So that's something that we're learning about Carson. From what you saw in Oakland compared to what he's doing here today with the Cardinals and the success that they have had now a year and a half, are you surprised by this at all? And how do you know Carson Palmer?
Well, I know Carson pretty well. I mean, from his days back in the Pac-10, I followed his career ever since he came out of college. You know, the thing is that I remember when the Raiders got Carson, there were a lot of talk about the Raiders, you know, Raider fans, the Raider people, Raider Nation saying that they gave up too much to get Carson. But I understood why Al Davis, the late, great Al Davis, did at the time. I thought Carson was a quarterback, and I still believe that. Carson is a quarterback who can make any throw on the football field. Now, his biggest deficit, or the reason why he didn't have success in Oakland, is that they didn't have receivers that create separation. I mean, a lot of times Carson was trying to put the ball in places where he couldn't get the ball into, and then, you know, disrupted by, you know, turnover or what have you. But he was not surrounded by the right weapons. More importantly, he did not have the right system that was conducive to his strengths. And I think Bruce Arians has corrected that. I think the Arizona Cardinals have corrected that. That's why I knew the Arizona Cardinals were going to be that much better at the quarterback position when they got him. Now you've got receivers that can get open. You've got you finally addressed the offensive line overall to where he's going to be protected. Now Carson can work his magic. And I think that's one of the reasons why they had double-digit wins last year, along with the stingy defense. And that's one of the reasons why they're good. I'm not surprised to see Carson come back. I know that he wanted to do everything he could to get on the field. The Cardinals were fortunate to win those games when they had Stanton in a quarterback. But Carson's their guy. If they're going to go anywhere this season, they need to have their main quarterback at the helm.
Lincoln, I'm curious your reaction to a story as a guy who has been both a player and entered the media realm. Aaron Rodgers had some really interesting comments yesterday about game day cameras, microphones, feeling they're a little bit too intrusive. He talked about a pregame huddle getting bumped in the head by a camera, things like that. You've kind of seen both sides of it. What do you feel about it as far as the intrusive aspect?
I totally agree with him. I think this is what I've noticed over the last decade. I understand why they're doing it. I don't necessarily agree with it. And even I'm a person in the media. I think there's incredibly too much access to the athlete. From social media to the locker room to everything else. There's got to be a subtle line that's drawn to where it's considered off limits. You have no business here. And this game has been, we're talking about football. Football has been around for almost 100 years, professional football. This game has been enjoyed from afar. This game was enjoyed when TV was not a regular. So why is it that you have to have a camera on the ground right behind the quarterback as he's going in the huddle? You don't need that access. So there has to be a line drawn. And there are times where, like with the locker room, you know, they had to open up the locker room when I was playing. I think it was like 10 minutes or 15 minutes after, you know, everything was done. And I know why they did it. They wanted to give people access. I certainly understand it. But there's times where I want a sacred ground. I don't want a camera shoved in my face. I don't want to have to worry about covering myself up. And I don't think that you have that these days because the NFL wants to give you access to your star player. But like Marshawn Lynch, what if you don't want to talk? Why am I getting fined for because I don't want to talk? You follow my point?
Sure. No question.
So
about
there
it.
Are times where, you know, I know the media, the beat writers, I know, you know, guys like Jared and I, we talked about it at our Rattler game. We know that there are times we want to give the best to our audience. We want to let our audience know from a fan's a player's perspective what happened during the game. Oh, well, I can't wait to talk to this player. You have 3 touchdowns. I can't wait to talk to you. But we also understand the fact that sometimes the guys just don't want to do it or they're worn out. And that should be okay. You shouldn't find it or hold against or look down your nose and say, well, you got to do it. I don't believe in that.
Agree 100%. I thank you for bringing us that perspective. Lincoln Kennedy joining us, the Oakland Raiders. Gosh, I am struggling with just saying Oakland Raiders. It's crazy. The Raiders sideline analyst getting us ready for Cardinals Raider on Sunday. One last question for you, just getting back to this game. Some keys on both sides of the ball for the Raiders to try to get over that hump, getting their first win, and also from what you see on the Cardinals side of the ball.
Well, I do know this. You know, the San Diego Chargers took the Oakland Raiders light. They thought they were going to walk in and just walk all over them because they had a better record and were known as one of the better teams in the league. And that sort of that almost cost them because the Raiders were in the game well at the end. The Cardinals could ill afford to have that. More importantly, because you know both teams are going to go through a rigorous and treacherous you know conference schedule, this is one that both teams really need. I know the Raiders want to get their first win, so I'm hoping that they show as much passion and growth as they did between the Miami game that they played in London, the bye week into San Diego, and now to progress into Arizona. But more importantly for the Cardinals, just keep on pace because you don't want to drop a game when you're trying to keep pace with the 49ers and the Chargers. I mean, in the Seahawks.
Is the team responding to Sparano well since the coaching change went down?
So far, so good. But, you know, I've always believed, Jared, that there's no such thing as a moral victory. So even though they came close and they played better last week, they still ended with a loss.
Lincoln, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Look forward to hearing your analysis on Sunday, and we'll catch up soon down the road.
Anytime, brother. Appreciate you guys having me. Have a great one.
course. That's Lincoln Kennedy, former Oakland Raider lineman, longtime lineman, took them to a Super Bowl, and radio color and sideline analyst for their radio broadcast now. Great guy, lives here in the Valley, and it's good to have some insight from him.
Just thoughtful. You know, I like listening to guys who have that sort of perspective and doing both the media and the, obviously he was a great player. It's interesting to hear him.
No question. And he was, it was funny, on a couple of our Rattlers broadcasts on by accident, I brought up the tuck rule game.
Oh dear.
And seeing him, seeing him, the look that the man that size gave me after I brought that up was not fun for me, but he was awesome about it. He's one of my favorite guys I've met since I've been in this industry. So, but coming up next, Michael Fabiano, your fantasy questions answered next. Who to start, who to sit, and who are some other players that are making some noise? We'll talk about some of those Raider guys and even a Cardinal guy after we talk to Lincoln too. So make sure you stick with us. That's Paula Bovin of AZ Central Sports. I'm Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad Sesmat on a Wednesday.
Giving you fantasy football insight you can't get anywhere else. With NFL Network and NFL.com fantasy expert Michael Fabiano, here's Brad Sesmat.
One of my favorite segments each and every week on the Brad Sesmat Show. My name is Jared Cohen. That's Paula Bovin. We're filling in for Brad today is when we get to be joined by Michael Fabiano, the NFL Network and NFL.com senior fantasy analyst. He joins us each and every week to get us up to date on the biggest news around fantasy football. And Michael, let's start. How are you doing? I know you got a ton of different teams. How are things shaping up for you through 6 weeks?
Yeah, not too bad. But when you're in 11 leagues, sometimes you have some bad luck. Last week, and I'm a Cowboys fan, and I think everyone knows that, that follows me on NFL.com, I had a less than 1 point lead at the end of the Cowboys game. Russell Wilson was my quarterback. He throws that pick. I lose 2 points. I lose by less than a point, but my Cowboys win. So overall, it was a good weekend.
Where do you draw the line? I mean, are you allegiance towards your team or to your squad?
Yes. I'd rather see the Cowboys win. I mean, obviously, for example, the Cowboys play the Giants this week, and if someone like, for example, Larry Donald was on my fantasy team, I'd want the Cowboys to win, but maybe give up a touchdown to him.
Yeah, right.
I try to shoot the moon.
If
and
they're
going to the
score,
best of both worlds,
let
you
know? It be him, right?
Exactly.
Well, that's one of the things I got out of fantasy football for a while and came back because I found myself rooting against my allegiances growing up. It became ugly, but I'm back on the horse.
Yeah, running. I don't do that. I still root for my team. But again, if things can work out where my team wins and the players against them that I have on my fantasy team do well, then so be it.
Let me ask you this question. Tom Brady's playing better. So for the rest of the season, would you start Brady? Would you start Cutler? Would you start Phillip Rivers? Or does it depend on the matchups?
Well, Rivers has sort of become a must-start every week, unless you have Rivers and Rodgers or Rivers and Breeze or Rivers and Luck, which is very possible because, remember, Phil wasn't drafted until the late rounds in most leagues. And Cutler's actually become kind of a must-start, too. He's been very good in that offense. He's stayed healthy. So he's up among the top five, top 10 quarterbacks in fantasy right now. I don't think Brady's there yet. You have to be encouraged about what he's done the last couple of weeks. I mean, he scored over 50 fantasy points in his last two games. In his first four games, he hadn't even scored 40 fantasy points combined. So you've got to like what you're seeing there. I want to see more. He's got a game against the Jets on NFL Network and CBS on Thursday night, which, by the way, if you look at Brady's numbers at home against the Jets, 12 career games against New York in New England, only 12 touchdowns. So I want to see what he does on Thursday night. Two games, though, is the start of a nice streak for Brady.
There have been some interesting players that have been dropped over the last few weeks. One of them, Tom Brady, who is being dropped in some weeks because of the numbers that you mentioned. But also guys like Maurice Jones-Drew and even one league I've seen, Matt Asiata has been dropped. Are these some guys that you think should just be stashed no matter what, even if the production hasn't been there over the last couple weeks?
I actually am not against dropping any of those guys. Chris Johnson, he's a name. He's not producing. It looks like they're phasing him out of the offense. C.J. Spiller, he's just a name. He's not producing. And if you can pick up a hot free agent and you have to drop one of those guys, I don't feel bad about that at all. It's been 6 weeks. We have a pretty good sample size of what these guys have done this year. And you can't hold on to names. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. Keenan Allen, he's had one game all year with double-digit fantasy points. Malcolm Floyd has been much better than him in fantasy. So I wouldn't be adverse to dropping Keenan Allen and picking up Malcolm Floyd at this point, because Allen has got a six-game sample size where he's not producing. Maybe it's because defenses are now keying on him. Maybe it's because the Chargers have more weapons in the passing game because Floyd was out last year. Gates wasn't as productive as he's been this season. So after six games, I mean, this is a trend. It's not a one- or two-game fluke, let's put it that way. So get the guys who are producing for your fantasy football team and forget about name guys who were good maybe a year or two ago.
You know, guys that that's always producing is Andrew Luck. Do you consider him the best fantasy quarterback no matter what team he faces, or is it Peyton Manning still in that top pick?
Well, I mean, throw up a coin in the air and see where it lands. They're both phenomenal, but Luck has been the better quarterback this year so far. He has broken out. He has become one of the three elite quarterbacks in the league. He's surpassed Aaron Rodgers and Drew Brees at the position, and it's a battle between him and Peyton Manning. Either way, you're starting those guys regardless of the matchups. But the addition of Hakeem Nicks to T.Y. Hilton and the return of Dwayne Allen and Reggie Wayne coming back and an actual running game with Ahmad Bradshaw and Trent Richardson as well has really helped him, and they're throwing the ball more. Remember, Pat Hamilton is the offensive coordinator from Stanford, so he's got Luck back in the shotgun. They are, unfortunately, their offensive line has got a few issues here, but it hasn't been too bad for Luck in terms of being sacked and having pressure. But he is so good, and he, coming out of college, everyone knew that he was going to be a phenomenal NFL quarterback, but he has taken it to the next level from a statistical perspective this year, and that's why he's such a king in fantasy right now.
Michael Fabiano, NFL Network and NFL.com senior analyst, joining Jared Cohen and Paula Bovin here on the Brad Sesmatch Show. I've got to ask you, Arian Foster. Now, this was a guy that used to be the number one overall pick in fantasy drafts. Hasn't been really that type of player the last year or so, but last couple of weeks we're starting to see kind of flashes of his former self. Do you kind of hold him in that regard yet again, or does he still have more to prove?
When he's been on the field, he's been great. He is an elite fantasy running back. His problem has been injuries, and that was what I was worried about coming into the season. He's coming off of back surgery, then he had the hamstring, he didn't do anything in the preseason, so that was where I was concerned. Right now, he is hot. He is red hot. And you ride a guy like this while he's hot. Maybe you sell high on him if you're worried about injuries creeping up again. But right now, he looks like he's healthy. And as long as Foster is healthy and playing well, he's got to be a must-start in your fantasy football team. This is a guy who was the top running back in fantasy football just a couple of years ago, and it looks like he's trying to reclaim that throne, although DeMarco Murray probably has something to say about that.
Well, and along that same line, should we believe that Ben Tate is healthy and can kind of sustain his number one running back status?
The Browns believe in him. Terrence West and Isaiah Crowell had played pretty well in his absence. He came back. There wasn't even a question. He was a starter again. And in the last two games, he has produced double-digit fantasy points, a couple of touchdowns last week. He's got a great matchup this week playing against the Jaguars. So Ben Tate, he's a talented guy. He's very talented. He just was always behind Arian Foster in Houston, and he's always had problems with injuries. He's another guy. He's not on Foster's level from a fantasy perspective, but when he's healthy, at worst, he's a high-end flex starter, and at best, he's a high RB2.
Michael, who are some of your best, most important starts and guys that you really think need to be sat this week?
Well, we can go through position by position, and I'll give you a couple of guys per. I really like Kaepernick this week, Colin Kaepernick against the Broncos. You look at his numbers on the road, they have been phenomenal, and he proved that last week against the St. Louis Rams on Monday Night Football. I also like Tony Romo this week against the Giants. He's averaging over 308 passing yards with 14 touchdown passes in his last six games against the G-Men. Now, quarterbacks that I would sit this week, Matt Ryan, don't like him on the road, don't like him in Baltimore, very tough matchup. And I'm not saying that you want to sit Drew Brees, but I am telling you this. If you have Phillip Rivers, if you have another quarterback that you have a lot of confidence in, I would sit him against Detroit. Detroit is the best defense in the entire league. They're nasty at home, and Brees has not been good on the road in his career, and that is also been the case this season. So I would definitely think about sitting Drew Brees. Guys, I'm starting Justin Forsett at running back. We mentioned Ben Tate. Alfred Morris is a great start at running back. Guys, I'm sitting Zach Stacy. Bad matchup against Seattle. Looks like he's in a committee now. Ronnie Hillman, really good last week against the Jets, but this is a very tough matchup against the San Francisco 49ers. So he's a guy that I think is a low flex at best because of the matchup. And at wide receiver, guys that I like this week, Emmanuel Sanders, Mike Wallace, Golden Tate, T.Y. Hilton. Guys that I'm sitting down, Percy Harvin, Roddy White. Listen to this stat. Roddy White has 2 touchdowns in 19 career road games against the AFC. Crazy stat, crazy trend, but it's true and it's out there. And another guy that I wouldn't play this week is Eric Decker for one reason and one reason only, Darrell Revis.
Yeah. Well, let's keep that wide receiver theme going. Would you play Larry Fitzgerald? Would you start him? Is he playing well enough to convince he's, you know, better options again?
I would start him. It was good to see him put up a good stat line last week. And they are playing the Raiders this week, which is a very good matchup. And the Raiders have actually been worse at home defensively than they've been on the road. So I like the matchup.
Michael, you mentioned a couple of Baltimore Ravens there when you're going through some of the start and sits, like the four sets.
Right.
And Torrey Smith. We had a Torrey Smith sighting last week. Is this the start of things to come, or is this just another unreliable guy as always?
Unreliable. And to be honest with you, I think Torrey Smith is a guy that you want to trade now because his value is not going to be any higher. Steve Smith is the main wide receiver in Baltimore this year, and Torrey is very inconsistent. Again, not a guy that I trust, a guy that I would try to sell high on right now.
And one last one for you, Michael. Steelers Nation seems to be in panic mode because of what they're doing on the field. But from a fantasy perspective, are you, if you own some of these players, are you in panic mode?
Well, I mean, Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell are must-start guys. Ben Roethlisberger is what he is. He's never been a great fantasy quarterback. He's been unreliable. You can play the matchups with him. Sometimes he'll produce, sometimes he won't. But really, outside of Le'Veon Bell and Antonio Brown, there isn't really a Steelers player who's a reliable fantasy option. Marcus Wheaton's got upside, but he's unreliable. Heath Miller has had one good game all season long. Their defense, not a good fantasy option anymore. Roethlisberger, more of a matchup-based guy. So you're starting Bell, you're starting Brown, no questions asked. Other than that, Pittsburgh doesn't have a lot to like from a fantasy football perspective. Let's put it that way.
I don't know about you, but having watched a lot of Wheaton, even starting from high school out here, then at the college level at Oregon State, I thought he was going to be a perfect fit in that offense. It just doesn't seem like it's clicked yet.
Well, he's only in his second year, so there's plenty of time for him to improve. But I mean, this is not an offense that spreads the ball out a lot. Antonio Brown sees the majority of the targets in that offense. And then you've got some that go to Wheaton, some that go to Heath Miller. You've got a pass-catching running back in Le'Veon Bell. He's going to see touches and targets as well. So there's sort of it's going to be hard for Wheaton to really make a huge impact unless he starts seeing more targets in the offense, which means Roethlisberger has to gain trust in him and Wheaton has to get open.
Michael, thank you so much for your time. As always, we appreciate it. Great insight. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Take care.
That's Michael Fabiano, NFL Network and NFL.com senior fantasy analyst, joining myself, Jared Cohen, and Paula Bovin here on Sports360AZ.com and AZ Central Sports.